Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Photographer Mindset Podcast. I just had something awesome arrive in the mail. It's a 30 by 12 photo on acrylic under glass printed by the sponsor of today's episode, and that's Whitewall. Whitewall, of course, is a photo printing lab. They have tons of different substrates, including aluminum, acrylic, canvas, and more. I just quickly wanted to talk about my experience printing with Whitewall. Honestly, this says a lot. The most difficult part of the process was picking which image to print. I ordered a 30 by 12 picture of a polar bear from my time spent in Manitoba, and I am giddy. It's got to go up in the studio real quick as soon as I'm done recording this because it looks so good. The print showed up in 6 days, which was under the 9 days they said it would take. So under promise, over deliver, they ticked off that box nicely. It came undamaged, which you would think is a given, but I've had sadly experiences in the past where with other manufacturers where things have not come in good condition. Obviously, we can't always control shippers, but the packaging was really robust and had nice bubble wrap, and it gives me confidence that if I continue to order from Whitewall, I'll get prints that come undamaged. So important. And I have nothing but good things to say. It looks great. I got to get it up in the studio. I got to finish this ad so I can hang it. But if you're considering printing your photos, or if you're going to be shipping directly to clients, consider Whitewall for your photo printing needs. Tons of different options. You have custom sizing, lots and lots of cool things. So check out the link in the episode description. Today, our guest is Arthur Lafoe. It's his second time back on the podcast. I think his first time was back in 2021, before Aaron, before Mantis Photography, or BM, as we shortened it to, which is not the greatest acronym. Arthur is a bear guide in Alaska for most of the year, and he is also an OM Systems ambassador. OM Systems is formerly known as Olympus. It's always a pleasure talking to Arthur. He's very, very well spoken. We hit a lot today on the topic of novelty, how that can work wonders for you and work against you if it kind of gets out of control, the constant seek for novelty. More on that in the episode. We're interested to hear your opinion. So if you're listening on Spotify, weigh in using the Q&A section. You can offer your opinion. We publish those, and you can also answer the polls that we put up. It's a fun way to be able to interact with our audience. And we just hit 200 ratings on Spotify. So thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who's rated the show. And if you haven't, please feel free to do that. It's a cost-free, effective way to support the podcast. And with that, let's get into today's episode.
Yeah, I was born in France and moved to Miami at a really young age when my dad was offered a job out here. I was originally born in the suburbs of Paris, and moving out here, I moved out here, I was 2 months old, so I have only known this place growing up, even though I'm, was raised by very French parents who are still very French and sound very French. I was raised in a, I wouldn't say mostly American because of the nature of the culture of Miami, but, very much as a Floridian. And that's really where, growing up on an island here is what allowed me to discover my love for nature, right? Mm-hmm. Which wasn't in, the mountains or in Yellowstone or, up as far north as Alaska, which is, come to think of it as an adult, it's the polar opposite end of the country from where I was born. I couldn't get much further. But at the same time, being out here is what allowed me to kind of discover these things about myself and to explore the ocean mainly, right? Most of my exploring was underwater, free diving and, spearfishing and scuba diving and going fishing off of a kayak and exploring mangrove tunnels, all that kind of stuff is really what got me into enjoying nature. That all took off more when I moved to Colorado. So
why did you leave again?
Why did I leave Florida?
Yeah.
So I grew up here and I went to school up north in northern Florida, at University of Florida in Gainesville. And I really liked it up there. It was inland, so it was an hour and a half from the ocean on either side, kind of smack dab in the middle of the state. And it was it was a really great time then to explore nature as well. I got to discover kind of some of the hidden treasures of Northern Florida that most people overlook when they think of Florida. They just think of, you know, beaches and palm trees and that's about it. But there's so much cool wilderness and nature inland in Florida that I got to discover while, you know, living in Gainesville. And coincidentally, I had friends from my childhood in Florida that moved out to Colorado when I was about 12. And so, you know, they were family friends. So like we would go visit them every now and then. And when I was in college, I started going to Colorado a lot more, to the point of like the last couple of years I lived in Florida, I was going to Colorado like 3 or 4 times a year. Mostly at the time for a variety of nature and also live music, which is another one of my, you know, my other loves, I guess you could say. But after going that much, you know, that frequently, it got to the point where I was like, well, I'm buying 4 flights a year. Like, I might as well just pay rent. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
And I kind of just said, why not? You know, and just decided to move out there. I wasn't really tempted to come back to Miami. I kind of just wanted to experience something new, you know? And so I moved out to Boulder, Colorado, after I finished college in 2017.
Yeah. And obviously this is our, well, maybe not obviously, this is our second time interviewing you.
Yeah. Right,
Aaron, were you part of the first interview with Arthur? Was it way back in the beginnings of the show?
It was just us two. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Aaron was the
BM before Manus.
So
before man, BM. juvenile joke. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I should go back and myself and listen to that episode, and everyone else should, so that we can see the progress of us as photographers, as hosts and guests. Where were you at last time in terms of just life and photography? Do you recall?
Yeah, I do. I do. More or less. You know, I think the first interview was a few months after I had moved to Jackson. I think it was in the spring of 2021.
Okay.
And I was just starting to gain traction as in my photography career.
Okay, let's pause. Can I interrupt? Can I be rude and interrupt?
Yes.
What is traction?
That's a great question. At the time,
thank you.
at the time, to me, traction meant getting my work noticed.
Okay.
Which in this day and age is social media.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this was a period of time where I went from sharing photos in, you know, mid 2020 to a network of followers on my personal Instagram, which has grown into my professional Instagram, which at the time was just, you know, friends and family. And, you know, fast forward 6 to 8 months later, you know, that was starting to grow significantly. I think by that point it had probably, you know, close to tripled, back when Instagram was a little easier to work with. And you know, so that was a point where like other opportunities started popping up too, which I think it ties into the traction element, right? When I started guiding full time, Olympus, now OM System, you know, started following me and reaching out to me maybe just a couple of months after my first podcast, or a few weeks after my first podcast on Photographer Mindset, they reached out and wanted me to do a webinar.
We jump-started your career. It's all our fault.
Wow.
Oh, thanks, you.
Go us. I wasn't even there. Go me.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were either the first or the second podcast to invite me on ever. And cool.
How many have you been on since?
I think like 4 more.
All right, copycats.
Yeah.
4 more. Some of them have been like really photo-centric in terms of like photography techniques.
Right.
Some of them have been very conservation-centric. If you've heard of The Wolf Connection, that podcast, I was on with them. So yeah, it's been a little bit of variety. A lot of them have had sort of similar overlap. You know, I've told I told the story of how I got into photography kind of a few times on a few podcasts. So that's something that I think, you know, most people have heard by now, I think, including this one too.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, did you have the luxury of enjoying and exploring nature and doing all these things you talked about at the beginning of the episode prior to ever picking up a camera?
No. Well, you mean in the last episode, did we talk about me?
Well, just either way, just the question on its own, I guess. Were you exploring nature and things with your camera? Let's do it this way, with your camera before socials were a thing.
Definitely.
Cause that's a good luxury to have, in my opinion.
Definitely. I say this a lot. I've actually been sort of leaning on this heavily in recent presentations for OM System. And I've always said this in almost every webinar or lesson or anything I've ever taught. I am a nature lover first and a photographer second. I first picked up a camera in 2018. And before that, my entire life, my entire childhood, ironically, I did like taking photos on my iPhone. But I never took it seriously. I never saw it as anything but like, you know, just snapping a memory, which I guess it still is that very much so. But, you know, for me, it was always about my own personal enjoyment of nature, sort of selfishly, you know, I'll admit, you know, I just loved spending time outside, but also maybe not so selfishly because I always loved spending time outside, but also bringing friends into the outdoors, which has very heavily translated into my career as a guide, right? Which is, that's basically what I do. That's the third piece to the triangle puzzle of like, what am I doing with my life that sort of brought everything together in the last 3 years was guiding and making that a core element of my life and my approach to enjoying nature and wilderness.
Do you have what the hell am I doing moments? Like, is this worth my time? Am I spending my time the way I should be? Do you ever have those thoughts, or are you continually finding yourself where you should be in your own head?
I have those thoughts a lot.
I think we all do. I think that's why I enjoy asking.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely have those thoughts a lot, you know. Generally it's in the off season. So I guide really, really intense schedules all summer. I'm basically working, you know, 15 weeks straight, working every single day, not a single day off unless like I beg for one and then I get one. You know, or if I'm sick. But even then I usually work sick. But all that to say that like in the off season, I have a lot of downtime. I have a lot of time to, you know, think about reviewing images, editing images, you know, working on other aspects of my business, growing my second business, Think Wild. So, you know, starting to think about all that. And I always have these thoughts like, what am I doing? Is this what I need to be doing? Should I be doing something else? Should I get another job on the side? My brain's kind of crazy. And there's always these thoughts of, you know, why am I here? And is this really what I should keep doing? Right. But at the end of the day, I think there's always something that brings me back to it and shows me like, yeah, this is what you should be doing.
Can I ask a question? That's not, you don't have to get into super detail, but I'm just curious. I could see it going either way. Cause I honestly have no idea. Is guiding a lucrative endeavor, or is it more about the passion and the, just the experience that goes along with doing that all summer? Or is it like, hey, this part of summer is going to keep me afloat for the year because it is a very lucrative thing. And I'm lucky of however many people to have this job.
I think it's both, be honest. I think guiding in the scope that I do it now, where it requires being away for so long, where it is a very intensive season.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I love doing right now, and it's something that I think fits me in my youth, so to say, pretty mm-hmm. nicely. But it's not something that I see myself doing in this way, at least forever. And right now, because photography is such a challenging industry to make a living in nowadays, guiding is, for a lot of wildlife photographers, at least, guiding, I can't think of a single wildlife photographer my age that doesn't have guiding involved in some way, or has a totally separate career to you know, source their finances from.
Right.
And so it does pay the bills, right? Mm-hmm. Majority of my bills personally are paid by guiding. Mm-hmm. That's not the case for everyone. But that is the reality for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, you know, it's not the only source of income. And, you know, part of the reason why I'm diversifying a lot of my, you know, businesses and career and all that is exactly that, is to be able to have more of a balance in my life as a photographer, and to be able to, you know, guiding, I think, will always be a part of it
mm-hmm.
in some way, shape, or form. Not to the extreme that it is now, but, you know, maybe it'll be, you know, 1 to 2 weeks at a time, maybe three, you know, and then back home, not 4 months. And then in between that, kind of having the opportunity to, again, continue focusing on all the other aspects of, you know, being a photographer, whether that be, you know, working with partnerships, or, you know, writing articles, or selling prints or calendars. You know, at the end of the day, I think it takes piecing together a pretty complex puzzle to make it as a wildlife photographer nowadays.
Yeah.
And, you know, guiding is just, it's something that I love too, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to seem like it, I only do it for money, but it is a really convenient thing to love that also pays the bills.
Right.
And at the end of the day, I think the most important and the most impactful thing about guiding to me is that it really contributes far more heavily and directly to conservation
mm-hmm.
than anything else I think we do as wildlife photographers, right? Because there's, of course, issues and topics that might require immediate attention. Like, say, you know, getting signatures on to oppose a mine mm-hmm. in Alaska, to quote or reference something more recent. You know, like those are important things to be doing in conservation. But at the end of the day, what has the biggest impact, in my opinion, is bringing people into these places that we love so dearly, and empowering them to develop their own personal connection with these places, and to channel that inspiration into, you know, feeling confident in sharing their voice and how they mm-hmm. see things. Because at the end of the day, everyone has a unique voice and a unique perspective and a unique connection to wilderness. And I think everybody's perspective and outlook on wilderness is equally as valuable as anyone else's, right? Like mm-hmm. I might have, you know, more or less, you know, followers or whatever than someone else, but that doesn't matter. At the end of the day, like what really has impact and what really has influence is the circle of people that are directly around you and the people that you actually know on a personal level. And the more people get inspired by wilderness, the more people are going to choose to spend time in these areas, to learn about them, to care for them. And it's sort of a domino effect, right? Yeah. Like I might inspire someone to start taking photos of bears, and then that person is going to want to bring one of their friends, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's just spreading spider web of really deep and genuine connection and inspiration to these places that creates the biggest impact at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's well said. Really well said. I think, I mean, just while you're saying that, I'm smiling because I just had a conversation with someone. It's winter here. Pretty soon, birds are migrating and hatching, and there are these piping plovers on the shorelines of Connecticut. These little teeny cute as heck birds that you can photograph, but they close down the beaches, right? They fence off lots of areas. They protect their eggs. It's just very protected. No dogs on the beach, no anything. And I was just bringing it up to someone that's not into photography, but loves nature. And their response was like, "Oh, those freaking plovers, they ruin the beach," right? Because from a not thinking about it stance, it was like, "Oh, this is an inconvenience." But then when you stop them and you have an explanation and you're like, "Look at these pictures. Like look at the struggle of these little guys that can't fly for weeks, and there's coyotes and fox that are coming by and peregrine falcons that are swooping down to get them. Like they have a serious struggle, and we're just doing a little bit to protect them." The beach is closed for a couple weeks to help them continue on, you know, and it kind of, it's eye opening, and they're like, "Oh, wow. Right. Like that's so cute. Like I never realized blah, blah, blah." So it's just those little things, those little connections, those little stories that can have a domino effect. And now when their friends are complaining about the beach being closed, maybe they pass that on, you know? Right. So I hear you totally. I think that's really well explained, well connected. We're all connected.
I mean, I think it's ironic that you mentioned that, because I mean, as you were talking about that, I thought about bears, mm-hmm. right? In a place, I mean, even in Colorado, which ironically I've never seen a bear in Colorado, even though I've lived there for, minus the Jackson years, probably going on 5 years, 5 or 6 years. But there are plenty of black bears in Colorado, and you know, a lot of people who aren't as connected to these places, who might just be like, you know, casual folks just living in, say, small towns, or even, you know, in cities like Boulder, there's bears that visit neighborhoods there. You know, they might see these animals as nuisances, you know, and just kind of like without having the perspective, right, that you gain from having someone that understands and truly cares about them share with you, right? And mm-hmm. maybe for someone in Connecticut, it's someone sharing, you know, their truth or their views on plovers, and mm-hmm. and for someone in Colorado, it might be bears, and in other places, it might be wolves or wherever it might be. You know what I mean, it could be sharks, it could be literally anything. And at the end of the day, it's through kind of breaking down our preconceived notions about and assumptions about things that we don't understand that mm-hmm. we can not only understand them better, but I think grow to appreciate them. Right? Because naturally, through understanding comes appreciation.
Yeah. And that was a huge debate in Colorado about the wolves being reintroduced, right? That was huge fight of misunderstanding, like city versus the...
It still is.
Still is.
And I've been, you know, right in the middle of it, at least as a keyboard warrior, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And it's backfired too. I got banned from Instagram for, I got reported for spreading misinformation, I guess.
What?
When I was...
Wow.
I was literally solely referencing facts that are published by state wildlife agencies.
Wow.
I got banned for a week. I couldn't comment, like, do anything. I couldn't do anything. I could scroll, but that's it.
Huh.
Put in time out.
Did you know you were banned? Or like,
I knew I was
does
banned.
It tell you? Does it give you any info, like, what happened?
I tried to comment on a post, mm-hmm. and I got the notification, you can't do this action, or however they phrase it. Mm-hmm. Tell us if you think we made a mistake. So I'm like, tell us, you know, like, but tell us. And then nothing happens. You know,
thanks obviously. For telling us, nothing will happen.
and then I went to my post, and I had posted the day before, and people were commenting on one of my photos, and I tried to reply, and I couldn't even do that. And then I was just trying to scroll and like something, and I couldn't even do that. So it was a little frustrating, you know, because I was really approaching this very divisive issue. I will say, like, it's a complex issue. I'm not going to sit here and act like mm-hmm. wolves are easy to coexist with. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of people do nowadays, not just in wildlife, but in life and politics, is paint things as black or white.
Yeah.
When in reality, I think with almost every issue out there, there's a gray area that, you know, many people sit somewhere in the middle of. And, you know, my honest approach, which I'll be brutally honest, I was way more black and white just a few years ago. And it's through spending time in places like Wyoming and learning from both, you know, acclaimed wolf biologists and, you know, hearing both sides and also being around people that I, you know, disagreed with pretty staunchly, that I realized that there really was a lot more nuance to issues like this than I think a lot of people are willing to accept.
That's the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? And in the beginning, on a topic we're really interested in or passionate about, we think we know everything. And then we realize we hit the valley of despair where we're like, shit, I don't know anything. It's a big spike and a big dip.
Yeah.
Competency on the y-axis. And then, but over time, it gradually increases as you explore and discover and, you know, dig deeper. It's just something to be aware of because we all fall victim to it in different areas, at times.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, again, it's, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. Like at the beginning, you know, you feel really strongly about something. It's all heart, right? It's all passion. And I think everyone, whether, you know, whatever side you might fall on an issue, you know, I think at the end of the day, people speaking out of passion are genuinely of the mindset that they're doing something for the best, right? Mm-hmm. And that their beliefs are in line with what's best for whatever their beliefs are, right? And the point is, I think it comes from a good place, but it's through... I think most people come from a good place. Not all, but most, you know, and I think that, like you said, like it's by learning more and by being exposed to the other side, which I think is a critical point to bring up with a topic like wolves, is people not being willing to see the other side, whether that be, you know, ranchers or hunters not willing to see the side of, you know, people who want wildlife and more wild spaces, and then, you know, and vice versa, right? People who want more wild spaces and who want more wildlife just as a theoretical concept, you know, or a philosophical like approach to how the planet should be, you know, without considering like real life impacts to people that, you know, live and breathe in these places, a lot more than the casual, you know, city goer who may have voted for wolves in this case in Colorado.
Right. Well, I very much enjoy you, a big wolf guy, you know, have the maturity and the emotional intelligence to see the other side. Right. I think that's a trait we all need to have, or at least try to find within ourselves, especially regarding to topics we're very passionate about. Can you, for people who have no idea what the heck you're talking about, can you summarize what this is about in 30 seconds?
The wolf issue?
Yeah, just what's this debate? It's in Colorado, right?
Yeah, so long story short, wolves were introduced or were put on the ballot up for a vote as to whether or not they would be reintroduced in the state of Colorado.
Got it.
In the 2020 election, which is a first because historically speaking, biologists would make the decisions on whether or not things or animals would be reintroduced, as was the case in Yellowstone.
So you have non-experts voting.
Right. So it's...
Well, sorry, you have people who aren't biologists voting. They may be experts in their respective fields in regards to infrastructure.
Right. The term that we would refer to it by in the scope of wildlife is ballot box biology, which is a controversial thing that I have many qualms with. So I think a lot of people have issues with that. But long story short, it was put on the ballot and it passed by the slimmest of margins. I mean, we're talking like 50.2 to 49.8% or something like that. I can't remember the exact numbers, so don't quote me on that. But it was basically like down to like they had to count every single vote like under... You know, it came down to like less than 100,000 votes. So it was incredibly close, but it passed. It passed. And prior to that, there were people that were in favor of it, you know, experts, I guess you might call them, biologists, whatever, that were in favor of it. And there were also some that were against it. And there are complex reasons as to why they were for and against it. But I think what this has led to is, A, we did reintroduce wolves 2 months ago in Colorado. There's now 10 wolves that have been reintroduced through this initiative, and another, you know, 10 plus that are planned to be reintroduced over the next year. In addition to the two wolves that were, or at least two known wolves that were already in the state that had migrated down from Wyoming. So there's a lot of really, really interesting and really, really challenging times ahead for Colorado in terms of conservation and figuring out where wolves may or may not fit in the state.
That's interesting. And there's a lot, like you said, there's the city folk that are voting on issues that really probably won't, in this case, won't affect them and their living within Denver.
Correct.
And the wolves are introduced, if I heard right or read right, on the west side of the Rockies, Rocky Mountain National Park, right? Like northwest?
Yeah, just west. It's actually fairly close to Denver. It's just west of the Continental Divide. So
gotcha. Okay.
Summit County, Grand County, were two counties that were releasing wolves in, which is, you know, roughly an hour west of Denver. So, I mean, these wolves cover a huge amount of ground. And right now there's only 22 of them or sorry, 12 of them in the whole state. And we should be seeing some pups in the next 2 months, because this is the mating season. And you know, they will disperse, they will start covering more ground, they will start gaining territory probably over the majority of the state. And the reality is that, yeah, the majority of people who voted for the reintroduction are people who live in urban areas. And the majority of people who voted against it are people who are actually in the thick of it in terms of living alongside them. So it's created this really tense dynamic between both sides.
I'm sure we could do an entire episode on this.
That's funny.
To kind of put a bow on it, for people who are curious, where would you maybe send them to get all sides of the story and to make their own, I guess, decision in their own head? If they're just curious about ethical dilemmas like this, some people are, right?
But yeah.
It's important that you explore, you know. It's tough, right? Because I'm sure you have an emotional investment in a particular side of it. But I think it's important.
I do, but I feel like I've removed myself from that mostly. And I can accept the fact that there are things that I personally disagree with that should be okay. Mm-hmm.
Well said.
But, you know, long story short, if anyone wants to kind of find out more about this, if you want to read or watch some videos that are more on the pro-wolf side, there's a organization called the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project.
Okay.
It's a great organization. There's some really, really awesome videos and resources on there to kind of give insight into, you know, why wolves may belong in Colorado. And if you're looking to read sides against it, I don't know of any one source that, you know, might oppose it to the extent that, I mean, a lot of places do. I would just Google, you know, articles published by, you know, I don't know, Steamboat or, you know, just any one of the rural mountain towns in Colorado. If you look up wolves, if most media on wolves is negative, that's just the fact of the matter. Or you can just read Facebook comments. I mean,
right.
The fact of the matter is that that's where a lot of the, you know, honest and raw emotions and opinions come out. And
good sample size there. You know, right.
Just going on like the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Instagram, and you reference any post that might mention deer or elk or wolves, you know, there's generally a slew of comments of people disagreeing. None of them are very productive, and a lot of them are, you know, very bantery. But at the end of the day, there's really not one good source that like opposes wolves as a whole, because I don't think there's, you know, it's a lot of that is rooted in ideology that isn't applicable through science. It's just like a perspective of how things should be, and that doesn't mean that they're wrong, right?
Yeah, I think, right. It's socio-environmental, which is very interesting.
Right. Wildlife.
Yes, no question, Arthur. Is there a way for humans, wolves, and cattle, livestock, deer, elk, everyone to do what they're supposed to do? Like, just I don't want to say everyone get along, because some of the elk are not going to get along. And
we need to start with people getting along, but
very true.
Which is the first task. But the answer is yes, but it's difficult.
Probably takes money.
In a world where we have less and less wild spaces and more human encroachment on wild spaces, it's difficult to give animals like wolves, who need a lot of space, the opportunity to do their thing without being interrupted by our own interference in the natural world. But there are ways to coexist with wolves as ranchers. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be issues or depredation events, but there are a lot of resources and tools that have been in development to help mitigate that and reduce that significantly. You know, I personally buy beef from a ranch that's wolf friendly in Idaho, and I have it shipped to my door, because they implement methods to coexist with wolves around their ranch. It's an all women run ranch. We're seven sisters and two ecologists, and they do things
right.
What's
the ranch name?
Called Alder Spring Ranch.
Cool. It's really interesting. It's difficult to get people to buy into a protocol that isn't the path of least resistance. That's just unfortunate, right? Like, evolution has programmed us to take the path of least effort, right?
Yeah.
It's very difficult to rally everybody to do a hard thing. It's hard enough getting ourselves to do a hard thing. I'd be interested, Aaron, I'm sitting here thinking, I'd be interested to hear what Jad would have to say on this. Jad Davenport, who we had on, who's a wolf naturalist, who actually lives in Denver. Maybe I'll message him.
I haven't met him, but I've heard of him.
Jad is the wickedest dude ever. We did a podcast with him. Yeah. If you're curious, go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jad is really awesome, and he knows so much. You know, so much spend, and again, like we were talking about, spend so much time with biologists, spend so much time with his own eyes, writing, recording, researching, pen and paper, right? Things he notices. It's just wild. But to avoid getting bogged down in this, let's move on.
I have like four more questions about wolves, but
I know. I appreciate the insight.
Arthur, I'll message you on the side.
Yeah, we could be talking about this for like well over 2 hours.
And I recognize that. And unfortunately, I have to be the bad guy. So everybody who wanted to hear more about wolves, I'm really sorry. You can message Arthur.
A Joe Rogan long form, like a 3-hour podcast.
Like a 3-hour, and it's just all over the place.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. It would be fun, I agree. But let's move on.
But Seth's going to...
But I'm going to ruin the fun. I wanted to get back to, you know, you used the word traction early in the interview when I started gaining traction. Do you think that's something once you have traction, you have it, or are you always gaining traction? So in other words, if you're gaining traction right now, what does that look like in your career as you're a more advanced intermediate type thing?
You know, it's funny because my perspective of that has evolved over time. You know, at first, you know, I think there's a natural, for better or for worse, probably for worse, a natural focus that we put on, you know, reaching certain milestones in terms of where our posts, how they perform or how our account is performing or this or that, right? And for me, like a huge milestone that I would just like really cared about for a long time was like, and I may have even mentioned it on our podcast, first one. I don't remember where exactly it was then, but you know, getting to 10,000 followers was a huge like leap.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, upon hitting that, you know, fictional number that really doesn't mean much beyond just having a number on your screen, you know, I felt some sort of validation at the time, which I realized wasn't really meaningful quite quickly. And that same validation, so to say, has only diminished over time as I gain more quote unquote traction, right? At least in the original meaning of the term that I focused on back when I started photography, right? Because I just wanted to have my work get noticed, right? And to know, like, hey, like, people actually care about the stuff I'm sharing about and relate to it and feel connected to the places I'm in because of it and may feel inspired by places that they maybe will never have the privilege of visiting thanks to some of the stuff I'm sharing, right?
Right.
Now, as that's evolved and as, you know, my reach and followers and whatever traction, as I may have called it back in the day, has grown, I think we realize that the real impact is elsewhere, right? And that the way how many likes your photo gets or how many followers you have isn't really what's going to determine that. And, you know, the real things that really do matter as conservationists, in my case, because really the only reason I do what I do is to inspire people to protect these places. You know, that a lot of that lies elsewhere and that Instagram isn't paying the bills. And I mean, sure, it's a great tool to spread ideas and spread, you know, maybe trips like I'm planning now. But at the end of the day, that's not it, right? And there's so much more to it, whether it be bringing people into these places or whether it be, you know, creating just on a personal level, creating a foundation for yourself that's sustainable so that regardless of your level of impact, you can continue doing this in the way that's meaningful to yourself, right?
Yes.
For some people, that might be, as I mentioned, I made a reference earlier, that might be, you know, working a 9-to-5 and spending their weekends exploring and sharing these places. And that impact is just as important in my eyes as someone who decides to do it full time, like a psycho, like I do, and there's really no right way to approach it. At the end of the day, it comes down to the impact you're having, the people you're inspiring, honestly, in the simplest of forms, just like enjoying it yourself, right?
Right.
Enjoying it yourself, and that's why I mention all the time that I'm a nature lover first, because at the end of the day, I don't go out there at least, and I try to encourage people not to, in order to just get a photo, right? And to set out with something in mind that they want to capture. That's not my approach to photography. That never has been. To me, it's more about going out there, finding the space and the time to be present.
Yep.
Which sometimes it's, you know, being present on your own and really just, you know, feeling everything that's going on around you in nature and wilderness. And sometimes it's, you know, having people around you and helping connect those people to those places and feeling connected to them as a result, right? And fostering that. So it's traction really is just how much impact and how many dominoes you can knock over, which getting likes on Instagram or getting follows isn't really productive for. You know, people see photos and they scroll right past them after 5 seconds. You know, most people don't even read the caption. That's not impact.
Yeah. Right. I love what you just said, and it something came up the other day. And it just reminds me, I mean, early on, I recognized you can go out for a photo, let's say a great horned owl. There's one spotted and you're sitting there and that's what you're hoping for. That's what's in your head. The picture in your mind is I want this great horned owl to come out. And then some fox runs across and like, that's the photo. And there was no inkling in your mind of this special event that's going to happen. This sort of like, secret plan B of the universe that came out and gave you this. It could be a great blue heron, free Baltimore Oriole that shows up right in front of you that you just had no clue that that was going to be there, despite what you were hoping for.
Yeah.
And I got into a little tiff on social media, believe it or not, with someone because they were going to a very well-known place that everyone from New York City goes to photograph short-eared owls. And I've been there 3 times in 4 years. And I mean, it's not to say that I won't do something like that, but all I said was, it's kind of like going to the zoo. Like, and it wasn't a bad thing. Like, you know what you're going to get. It's almost a guarantee that these owls are going to be there. And you're shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of other photographers that have been sitting there all day. And all I said was, that's not fun for me. Like, isn't it more fun to go out and search and not know what you're going to see? And it just kind of presents itself to you. Or you find an owl on your own and you're by yourself with it. And you're like having this moment. I just said, like, there's two kinds of wildlife photographers, the ones that want the photo and the ones that want to actually be in nature and experience nature. And I meant no offense by it, but...
No, there's nothing wrong with either one.
No, there's nothing wrong with either one.
You're respecting the animals.
Right. There's just two different approaches, and some like one and some like the other.
You don't think that's a spectrum?
Yeah.
There's a spectrum. I mean, I myself... As someone who considers himself a nature photographer first, I've been to situations where, like, I knew what I was going to find, or like I knew that there was one specific animal that I was very likely to find.
Right.
And I have stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder. I mean, some trips you go on, you know, wildlife trips you go on. I mean, people who just come to the lodge I work at in Alaska, like, you know, you're going to see bears. Mm-hmm. But that being said, we also don't have that approach where, like, you know, we do take a very adventurous approach and kind of have the freedom as guides to go where we feel might be the most interesting or might provide the best, you know, encounters. And it's such a dynamic place. It's a little different, but all that to say that, like, yeah, I think everyone, you know, myself included, you know, the most advanced photographers or, you know, dedicated, I guess you should say, and some of the most amateur both have a spectrum they fall on. And I think both have been to encounters that would be classified as either one of those types of situations, right? Like,
yeah, of course. And that's not what I'm saying, that you have to pick one or the other. I'm just saying there are the both ends of the spectrum.
Right, right.
And one to me is, like you're saying, more enjoyable in terms of the whole experience in nature. It's just like a beautiful surprise, like when you don't know what exactly is going to happen.
Yeah. Right.
There's more opportunity to be exhilarated and like, oh my, like, I can't believe that happened today versus the other where you're like expecting it.
Right.
And,
right.
And maybe that animal that's supposed to be there isn't there and you're just deflated.
Right.
Like, so there's like more of that reward potential than like, I know that's going to be there and it is there. That's exciting versus I don't know what's going to happen. And oh my gosh, this thing happened. You know,
right.
It's just a very interesting philosophy and both ways are great. Like, of course we all want wonderful photo and there's a guaranteed animal that you have not seen before and you're treating it with respect and you can go there and there's a good percent chance that you're going to see it. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah. Right. What you're talking about is novelty, right? Like, if it's your first time driving to go see those short-eared owls and you've never seen an owl, like,
awesome.
That's a novel experience, right?
Yeah.
But if you do it 3-4 times and you know the landscape, it ceases to become as exciting because you know what you're anticipating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or you just come to know what to expect.
Yeah.
Right? It's adding or putting yourself in a situation where there's novelty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really gets the brain going, right?
Right.
You know, that's a really awesome way to put it, not gonna lie. And I've never thought of it using that term specifically, novelty, but.
Well, for example, you know you're gonna see bears, but you don't know if you're gonna see mom and cubs. Maybe you see mom and cubs 3 days in a row, but you don't know if she's gonna nurse.
Right.
There has to be a novel thing. That's why the zoo would be boring, right?
Like what you're saying, like novelty at the end of the day as wildlife photographers really drives us regardless of how, what kind of encounter we end up in to see an animal, I think novelty is personally, at least speaking for myself, like that's what drives me, right? Is those new experiences, is those, you know, maybe I've spent 3 months working at this lodge in Alaska, but it's that morning where a bear walks right in front of a stunning orange glowing sunrise with the perfect reflection that I'm like, holy crap, like this is happening. You know what I mean?
Right. There's so many variables.
Right. And, but then I could be standing at a, at an encounter like a day or even later that day where a bear is just grazing in a patch of grass. And I'm like, I've seen this happen 150 times. And that novelty isn't there. Whereas like first time you stand in the grass, you know, 25 yards from a wild brown bear just grazing, you are having the best time of your life.
Yeah,
right.
Not to say that it's still not amazing every time, but like there, that that element of like, wow,
yeah,
definitely fades naturally. So, you know, and I think that by approaching things from this standpoint where you are a little bit more spontaneous and not setting expectations.
That's just it.
And just going out just to like, hey, let's just go out and enjoy and see what happens. And thinking back to my, you know, two of the best encounters I've ever had in my life, which were ironically, now that I think about it, as I'm starting to talk about it, those two encounters were within, you know, a couple hundred yards of each other in Yellowstone. Both of those encounters were completely spontaneous encounters that we were not looking for these animals, and we got a completely different animal that completely rocked our world.
Yeah.
And ended up being, you know, still to this day, top five wildlife encounters I've ever had. Cool.
It's like it's like me landing in Colorado and seeing a magpie for the first time. And everyone's like, those things suck. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like they're so, they seem so smart and beautiful. Like what? We don't have birds like that.
Very underrated.
Yeah. I mean, but it's just, and I could take you from Alaska and bears to see baby plovers on the shoreline of Connecticut. I guaranteed you'd be like, whoa, like this is cool. Like let's get some photos.
That was like me this morning. And it's ironic because I grew up here, right? Mm-hmm. My parents live near the beach and I went on, I've been going on beach walks every morning and, you know, as a kid, I didn't really mind shorebirds. And this morning I'm walking and I'm just like, you know, watching the waves as they roll over the sand and picking up shells and finding stuff on the beach. And I see these, I don't even know what kind of birds, maybe they were plovers. Honestly, they may have been plovers.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I was like, whoa, those birds are so cool. You know what I mean? And I like laid on the ground with my iPhone. I didn't even have my camera and like put it on 3X and was just like, filming these little plovers or whatever they might be. I'm not a bird nerd, but you know, I loved it. Even though I grew up here, right? And I never noticed these little birds or took interest in them, but suddenly it's novel, right? It has an element of wow, I've never noticed this. It's new. It's fun.
This can get into trouble, where this can get you into trouble though, the desire for novelty is when you hit a roadblock, you know, and in, let's say, working on a website or brainstorming an idea.
Yeah.
And you need to move on to the next thing for it to remain exciting.
Rare.
You kind of get snagged. The passion dies. This isn't novel anymore. I need to do something else. That's why there's something to be said for showing up and doing the same boring thing. Like if you're able to sit through boredom and continue to do things that you've done a million times.
Yeah.
I think that eventually makes you elite.
Yeah, to bring it back to the music stuff.
How many unfinished songs, right?
Well, yeah, and just the ability when you write a song, record a song, do you know how many times you're playing and singing the same thing that you and it's from yourself? Like, give me my favorite song in the world, and if I try to record it, like, I'm gonna hate that song by the end of the time. Like, so there is a superpower for songwriters that get stuff out and make albums and are able to play, because it's not just what we hear, like that one time, like, oh, that's a cool song, next. Like, it's, oh, that's a cool song that they did 100 to 1,000 times in a row to now get it right.
It's, as someone who, as I mentioned, music is one of my other passions, and I did have a phase in my life where I thought I was going to be a producer and a DJ, and I meddled with production, and I can attest to that. It drives you crazy. You hear it to the point that you can't even hear it the same way. Like, I think we kind of get that with editing photos too, right? Like, you look at a photo for so long and you mess with so many things and you add all these gradients and all this and that. And eventually you're like, what am I even looking at? And you like, you have to put it down at some point and just like reset. But yeah, people can do that and keep producing top-notch content, whether it be photography, whether it be music, whether it be paintings, so like whatever it might be, whatever creative medium. I think it's a gift for people to be able to do that.
Right. Even just if you committed to posting every single day, that is mundane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. I think
really hard.
People who are very, have their sights set on seeing something to the end or to becoming a professional at it and not just being an amateur, are able to show up and do the boring routine and not get sucked into the fantasy of the next exciting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that's important to be aware of if you find yourself constantly going to the next thing and having a lot of unfinished projects, right? It could be perfectionism, but often it's not. Like there are people who aren't perfectionists who don't finish things. And I would wager that it's because it's lost the novelty factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you kind of need to find a way to, or a protocol or something to allow us to continue to, you know, to do the boring things.
Well,
and
that's true.
Sometimes where it creeps into your mind. You're like, why am I again, lifting weights. I mean, you don't change the way you lift weights, but that's get stronger.
Yep.
Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah. That's some Mamba mentality stuff, you know, you're referencing. It's like, it's the perseverance. It's the repetition. It's the going through the tough, boring, repetitive phases of whatever you're chasing, which is an animus, right? Like, regardless of
often that's just showing up though, right?
Yeah.
Just showing up. That's just showing up. I think I've said it before, like showing up puts you ahead of 95% of people. Showing up every day. even walking into a gym and leaving. I mean, you're still doing more than 95% of people.
In your car, driving there, walking in, like
doing a lap and leaving.
You know?
Yeah.
You're doing mentally, like that's it's the repetition, it's the process.
At the very least, you're building the identity of somebody who's committed to something, and it's taking you, in that example, taking you away from feeling that you need to lift a certain amount or you need to get a certain amount of likes on a photo. Just the act of doing and showing up perpetuates. And that circles back to what you were saying when we were talking on the second go around of traction, you know, how you were talking about it, in the beginning. It was about, maybe I heard you incorrectly, but in the very beginning, it was likes were very important. Follows are very important. And those bring opportunities. I understand that.
Yeah.
But there's a law. It's called Goodhart's Law. I had to pull it up because I didn't want to butcher the quote. It's when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. And I love that quote because it speaks to when you focus on something you can measure with a number, it overshadows the importance of anecdotal experience. So for example, let's say to use the weight loss thing, if you're measuring that you need to be 170 pounds and you weigh 200 and you've been running for months and you've been eating clean for months and the scale is not budging, if you're using that number as a measure of success, that's not very good. But maybe in the meantime, you've been sleeping great. Your mood is way better. You know, all these other things. There's just, you can
better,
really
you feel better.
You look better. You feel better. Yep. You have more energy. You're more mobile, but the scale isn't budging. In that example, what a terrible metric.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Or you alter your behavior that's inauthentic solely to hit a target. How often do we see that online?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to go viral. And then you stray from who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You game the system. The focus shifts from genuinely improving to simply just achieving the metric. And I think you can get lost. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good reminder to just, you know, stay true to yourself and do things that matter to you personally and that inspire you. And
Right, because like, what a shame to lose
the metrics, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What a shame to lose sight of the original purpose, right?
Yeah. Which I think for most people, I mean, I can't speak for all, but like, at least for me, it's, you know, just sharing things you love.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I think like numbers and milestones and likes and plays should be a byproduct. That should be a bonus, right?
If you get it and
the celebration should be, I created something new.
Yeah.
To the best of my ability. Even if you don't share that, that's an amazing feat.
Or the slightest bit new, like Arthur was saying he sees 150 bears and it, I don't want to say boring, but you get used to it. You get numbed to it. But then you're like, how can I improve this bear experience for myself? I'm gonna move over here. I know where the sun rises. I know where typically where they are in the morning. Let me get that perfect sunrise let me elevate this photo for that novelty.
Yeah.
I think that that becomes the next step when you spend a lot of time in nature with certain areas. When people are getting into wildlife, I always say, find a small spot of woods and know it. Know it like the back of your hand. You don't have to go far. You don't have to keep searching on eBird to go to this state park and this state park and this state. You're not going to find anything. You're chasing. Sit in a small piece of woods, and if there's one woodpecker, get the best woodpecker shot you can get. Spend a month trying to get the best woodpecker. That's to me the process and the novelty and the enjoyment in something simple versus reaching everywhere, throwing spaghetti everywhere, trying to find what it is that sticks.
My first wildlife shot was a chipmunk, and it's still one of my favorites to this day. Just like that's
a great one.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
behind a little piece of wood.
I know the shot.
Well, I hung it in my room. Like
that shot, I mean, used to see mentioned good. Like it's in my brain. You know what I mean?
Good.
You mentioned it briefly, but keeping a protocol, I think, is important. And
yes,
Arthur, you made me laugh because I was there too, and you probably remember this very well. Is that when you're starting off and you're getting a little bit of attention and a little bit of traction, you get to 1,000 followers, I'm going to do a giveaway. I'm going to do a free print to the first people. Like you're very excited with those things, and you're giving back because you feel like the attraction and the appreciation, but you don't see many giveaways for someone that's like, I got to 42,000 followers. I'm going to do a giveaway. Right. It's all the earlier people. Yeah. I feel like
it's novel.
It's novel. Right. That's what I'm saying. But keeping that protocol, maybe like every five, I'm gonna give back, or like keeping a structure that keeps you going and keeps you true to the excitement of where it is.
Yeah, I think something you said just a second ago that really, you know, and I'll be completely honest, really sort of hit home with me is this concept of chasing. Mm-hmm. Says, you know, in what you were saying, just like sitting there and learning, right, and like, you know, and the reason why that hit home for me is because I think in many ways, I started off as, and still to this day in many ways, am sort of a chaser, right? Mm-hmm. I chase those new novel experiences. There's something about that newness that draws me in, whether it be like seeing bears in a new place or this or that. And this, in my personal journey, is something that I've been coming to terms with a little bit more recently, and that's realizing that like the real value, just like what you said, the real value is not in the chase, right? It's in the novelty, and you can find novelty in almost anything. It all comes down to how you approach things, right? And you know, whether that be going on new trips, which I think at the end of the day, don't we all want to go to new places and experience the far corners of the world? I think that's only human, but I think it's equally important to realize that you can have the same level of fulfillment and novelty, I guess you should say, from doing very simple things, right? And finding, you know, like you said, spending a lot of time in the same place. I mean, earlier today I was photographing peacocks at this abandoned zoo that used to be the Miami Metro Zoo on the island where I grew up. And you know, there's these peacocks all over the place, and I've been there a million times as a kid, and I always liked these peacocks, but today I sat there and I just sat for 3 hours with peacocks rolling around me, and this one big male was strutting his stuff and trying to like back up to me, and like, you know, I was between him and his ladies, and he was getting a little feisty, but like I was just sitting there, right? And he was putting on this show that like would have never happened if you just like were walking around chasing, trying to get photos, right? You just sit there. And I think that's sort of like the lost art of wildlife photography, that is just sitting there and being bored and letting things unfold and yeah, just letting nature put on the show, however slow or fast or whatever it might be. And there's a film I watched recently that I'd like to just suggest to everyone that's listening. Maybe you guys have watched it, but it's a French photographer that I'm incredibly inspired by. His name is Vincent Meunier. I don't know how you would say that in French. It's Vincent Meunier. And he has a film that's, it's subtitled in English, but it's spoken in French. It's called The Velvet Queen.
We've both seen it.
Yeah. And that film really embodies the element of waiting and patience and perseverance and really immersing yourself in a landscape, and how that translates into these moments of novelty and magic that as photographers turn into our favorite images too.
Yeah, that movie's really good at showcasing no rush, slow. I have nowhere to be. I know we have places to be in our busy lives, but in this instance it was, you know, he's not sprinting up the mountain. He's spending time with the Tibetan kids, right?
Yeah.
It's just no rush, no hurry.
Until
it's time to do what I need to do. Exactly. Yeah. I think that's a very balanced place to come from.
Yeah.
There's a trend with horse therapy. Now hear me out. It's when you stand in a stable, and if you are balanced and not anxious and not nervous, the horse will graze around you. But they are herd animals. So if you are anxious or wound up or angry, they sense it and they flee. They go as far away from you as possible. So it's just a very quick picture of like, are you well? Or do you got stuff going on? And I always think about that when you're chasing and like walking through the woods, it's rare. It's like you're approaching, you're a predator. Like things are fleeing from your presence.
Yeah.
Whereas when you sit, it's quiet, and you might think this is never going to happen, but nature kind of unfolds back onto you. And then you're like, oh, there's a raccoon right there.
Cool. Yeah.
Like there's an otter. Like and it takes time and it feels unproductive. It feels like I'm not going to find anything. Nothing's here. I'm not going to find anything, but it's fighting that urge to go get it versus kind of letting it come.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, improving your square footage isn't going to improve your chances often. If you're already in a spot that's designed for you to win being get a photo or footage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And it can take days. It can take like returning day after day and letting the environment get used to you.
And get a trail cam too, because then that's inarguable. There are things in this area.
It's true.
There are things in this area that frequent at these times.
Wow.
How do you argue that?
You can't.
Trail cams are magic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Arthur, I have to ask one question because I've always loved your editing. You mentioned you are first like a nature enthusiast, then a photographer, but you never mention you're an artist. And not to pump your tires too much, but from the beginning, I've just always loved your editing style. And similarly, there's often this argument between wildlife photography. I've had it myself with people, wildlife photography versus enhancing photos artistic photos. I'm curious your thoughts on that line and your approach to editing photos, because it is very unique. It is very artistic. I think you put a lot of thought into your edits and the colors and the look. And it's my favorite style of wildlife photography. It lends a little something to me. I don't know what it is. It might just be a personal preference.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. So I don't want to not touch on that.
Yeah. You know, we all take photos for different reasons. I think we can start with that.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said earlier, we all have our own personal, unique connection to wilderness. And I think that whether or not people edit photos or how they edit photos is simply a reflection of that. Right. I think that's a simple fact. And some people might be purists and never touch a photo and just shoot JPEGs or whatever and, you know, just let them be. And others might create drastic, dramatic, incredibly moody, like night and day edits to what the raw image may have looked like, which isn't really where I'm at, but also some of my images have been very, very drastic, so I can't say I've never done it. And I think that's what makes photography so interesting nowadays, mm-hmm. right? It's that photography, and I talk about this a lot in a lot of my, you know, workshops and speeches and whatnot, but like photography used to historically be a one-step process where you've got a film camera, you go out, dial in your settings, you expose your image, click. You take a shot, you go home, you develop it, that's your shot. End of story. Today, it's a three-step process, in my mind. The first step is taking the shot, which mm-hmm. has gotten easier than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
Cameras nowadays literally do all the work for you. I mean, you could shoot on auto ISO with subject tracking on, and you know, as long as your aperture and whatever, and you have the reflex and the eye to compose the shot correctly and snap it, you know, you know how to work your camera to a certain extent, like you'll get a photo. It's pretty easy to get a photo
mm-hmm.
today in a way that would have taken a lot of skill 30 years ago. Now, the second step is, let me fast forward to the third step, which is editing, right? And I think the second step, which is often overlooked, is choosing the right photo. Because nowadays, not only can we take photos, but we take thousands of photos. And you can come home from a tenement encounter with a wolf like I had in June of 2021. And in 10 minutes, you've got 1,500 images. And you're like, then you got to pick the right ones, right? Because it's mm-hmm. not just photos. It's which photo has the right light, the right sharpness, the right eye contact, the mm-hmm. right pose, the right everything to deliver that impact. And then once you pick that photo, it's taking it to that third step. And this is, you know, to circle back to your question, where I think photography gets so fascinating nowadays is that you could be standing shoulder to shoulder with someone taking mm-hmm. another image and come home with two completely different end results.
Yeah.
And so my approach, to answer your question, my approach is I go out there and again, I have my own connection to wilderness and my own, you know, emotions that come about from my experiences out there. I'm really, really inspired by pretty much every photo I've shared are moments that like I have been inspired by. There of course are some photos that I notice are good photos after the fact, but at the end of the day, you know, in the moment I'm inspired by them and I can remember these moments vividly in my mind. And when I edit photos, I do nothing more than simply try to bring a moment to life in the way that I saw and I felt it in that moment. It's as simple as that to me. that might sound excessively simplistic to some. At the end of the day, I've never taken a class on editing. I've actually never even watched a YouTube video on editing. All I've done is messed around and found out and maybe watched some friends edit, right? You learn a lot from watching other people edit. You know, Brooke and I and Tiffany and John, we've all had, you know, really fun editing parties where we're just like flipping photos or we're all editing photos of the same encounter. And we're like, holy crap, like, I love how you did that. You know what I mean? But at the end of the day, it's bringing out that emotion that like I felt in the moment and how in my mind, I remember things like the colors, things like the lighting and putting emphasis on the parts of the photo that really bring about emotion to me, mm-hmm. right? For how I saw the moment, for again, my personal connection to wilderness in that moment. And that I think is what makes it so beautiful and so fascinating, right? Is that we all have these different perspectives. And I mean, just to quote some people that have been past guests on this show, like, you know, Brooke might have dramatic, contrasty, like intense shadows and highlights and, you know, like real dramatic, moody approach. Whereas like for my photos, like they might be a little bit more on the, you know, a little bit more pastel, a little bit more saturated, a little bit more, you know, just a different feel. I don't mm-hmm. even know how to describe it. They're just different, right? And I think mm-hmm. that's what makes editing such an awesome thing. And I think it's, my personal opinion is I think it's just kind of a shame to bash it because like,
yeah.
there's so much emotion that comes out of editing and that comes out of removing distractions and enhancing lighting and just making a moment feel like how you experienced it.
Yep. Well said.
Yeah.
Wow. That's got to cap the show.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
We could go on for a long time. Arthur, you're so well spoken, man. It's been awesome to see your career kind of progress from very humble beginnings when we first started talking. OM Systems Ambassador now and doing workshops and all these cool things on the Photographer Mindset podcast for the second time.
That's what it's all about.
That's at the top of the resume. But we do
appreciate
your time, man. And
thank you
for check out your new business. What is it? Think Wild
Expeditions. Think Wild Expeditions.
Link is in the episode description if you're interested in checking that out. And just once again, man, it's always a pleasure talking with you, whether it's in the virtual flesh here or digitally through DM. So appreciate you having on, and so do listeners.
As always, you guys rock. You guys keep a really interesting conversation flowing and ask the right questions, and always
thank you.
Fun podcasts and fun conversations.
We'll wave at you in Alaska this summer. So wave back.
Yeah, cool. You better.
All right. Till next time, guys.
Cheers.
See ya.